You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down to earth.
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja.
We love the earth.
It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Wednesday, October 18th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Welcome back to the program. So glad to have you here as we continue this week's look at the International Drug Policy Reform Conference 2017, just completed this last week in Atlanta, Georgia. Happens every 2 years. The next conference, 2019, will be in St. Louis, Missouri. That was great news, as I know many people in the state of Missouri who are fighting for an end to adult marijuana prohibition. They came so close, 23 signatures away from getting on the ballot for medical marijuana in 2016. They're not going to make that mistake again. I was at the Oregon National Cannabis Industry Association quarterly caucus last night. Got to speak with Anthony Johnson and Sarah Duff, transplants from Missouri, who are very excited about the prospects of the Reform Conference happening 2019 in St. Louis. Check out reformconference.org if you want to get more information. Plus, they got information on this prior conference we just had just last week in Atlanta, 2017. And for today's look, we're going to do some pot and public policy. I highlighted this in my column in hightimes.com just a couple days ago, or yesterday, I think maybe it was released. And it features a discussion between Steve Fox and Dan Riffle, both of whom were policy analysts, policy people for Marijuana Policy Project, with differing takes on the policies around marijuana compared to the policies compared on alcohol. Steve Fox thinks marijuana policies ought to be less than alcohol, and Dan makes a compelling argument as to why marijuana policies should be set regardless where the alcohol policies are. It's an interesting discussion. I think one that all drug reformers should start to pay heed to. And I'll talk about that more in the radical rant, where I'll ask the question, if alcohol is a drug and we know how deadly it is, how come we're not doing more in the drug reform community to talk about alcohol harm reduction and altering alcohol public policy to help reduce deaths, more deaths than we're getting from the opioid overdose crisis right now? We'll get to all that, but first, let's get to the cannabis headline news.
This is your cannabis headline news, brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net. The complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for Wednesday, October 18th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. Representative Earl Blumenauer, one of Congress's leading champions for marijuana law reform, is going beyond just trying to pass legislation to push back against federal prohibition and is now actively working to defeat fellow lawmakers who are standing in the way of those bills. His first target is Congressman Pete Sessions, a Republican of Texas. As chairman of the powerful House Rules Committee, Sessions, who is not related to U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has played a key role in preventing marijuana legislation from advancing. In that capacity, Sessions has blocked a number of cannabis measures from even being considered on the House floor, including ones to protect state laws from federal interference, facilitate marijuana businesses' access to banking services, and a measure to let military veterans get medical cannabis recommendations through the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Quote, "We're going to be putting up some billboards in Pete Sessions' district. It's going to feature a veteran and ask the question why Pete Sessions doesn't want him to have access to his medicine," end quote, Blumenauer said. The Department of Justice has agreed with defense lawyers that five Washington state residents who said they grew and used marijuana for medical reasons and had complied with state law, and that the U.S. government shouldn't have pursued federal charges against them. In a brief filed late Monday in the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Department of Justice lawyers acknowledged that the department, quote, was not authorized to spend money on the prosecutions of the defendants after December of 2014 because the defendants strictly complied with the Washington state medical marijuana laws, end quote. The defendants became known as the Kettle Falls Five because of the region in eastern Washington where they live. Three have been facing prison time following the death from cancer in 2015 of Larry Harvey, the patriarch of the family in the case, and a plea deal taken by family friend Jason Zucker to testify against the other defendants. In 2016, the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court ruled unanimously that the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment blocks federal officials from prosecuting state legal marijuana operators and patients. The DOJ lawyers cited that ruling in the brief filed Monday. The Trump administration plans to review the powers that law enforcement officials have under existing opioid laws and request additional authority from Congress if needed, a top official at the Department of Justice said Tuesday. Quote, "We're going to review it," end quote, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said when asked by a reporter if current regulatory laws are sufficient to control the opioid epidemic. The review comes as President Trump's pick to be the nation's drug czar, Representative Tom Marino, a Republican from Pennsylvania, withdrew from consideration Tuesday after news reports focused attention on Marino's role in weakening the Drug Enforcement Administration's power to combat opioid abuse, trafficking, and addiction. Candidates vying to be New Jersey's next lieutenant governor had a heated debate about marijuana legalization on Monday night. Republican candidate Carlos Rendo, currently the mayor of Woodcliff Lake, tore into his Democratic opponent and her running mate, calling them, quote, "the most anti-cop, anti-law enforcement ticket in the history of the state of New Jersey," end quote. The Republican also gave a shout out to the Reagan administration's war on drugs, as well as a now infamous TV commercial comparing a smashed egg to the brains of people who consume drugs. Quote, "I grew up during the 1980s, and one of the commercials that had an impact on me was Nancy Reagan's war on drugs," he said. "And I remember a commercial that said, this is an egg and this is the egg on drugs. That impacted me. And there's a reason why that commercial was done, because of the impact on the adolescents and marijuana use," end quote. With many of Northern California's cannabis growers losing their crops and homes in the recent wildfires, the crowdfunding site YouCaring has shut down a campaign to help them and their families recover. Leafly reports that Hezekiah Allen, founder and executive director of the California Growers Association, had set up a campaign on the San Francisco-based crowdfunding website called Cal Growers Wildlife Relief Fund. After the site had raised over $10,000, donors began receiving cancellations. YouCaring's parent company, WePay, explained in an email to Leafly that the company, quote, "is unable to process payments connected to the production, sale, or consumption of cannabis, even in situations where such activities would be permitted under state law," end quote. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Wednesday, October 18th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal Potland, Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House.
Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855.
The Marijuana Agenda. Like the liberal agenda, but with profits. Ka-ching.
If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
This is Pot and Public Policy. As marijuana legislation continues throughout the United States, it becomes less of an issue of if and when, and more of an issue of how the laws and regulations are crafted. Today, we learn more about the administration and bureaucracy behind ending adult cannabis prohibition with another expert from the world of pot and public policy.
In today's episode of Pot and Public Policy, we actually get the benefit of two experts on marijuana policy who are part of a panel discussion at the 2017 International Drug Reform Conference in Atlanta, Georgia. The policy experts in question are Steve Fox, currently with Vicente Cederberg Consulting, and Dan Riffle, who is currently working in government. And the debate featured a question about alcohol and its relation to marijuana policy. Steve Fox, of course, is one of the co-authors of the seminal book Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink?, and one of the proponents of the Marijuana is Safer philosophy. In this discussion, Riffle asks whether or not marijuana is safer than alcohol should be a determinant as to whether the policies should be safer than alcohol. We go to the video from the Atlanta Drug Policy Reform Conference 2017.
Thanks very much. I'm going to turn now to Steve and Dan, and also, I guess, invite. So the idea is, if you're in a normal capitalist system and marijuana is just another product, then people who are selling it should be able to talk to their potential consumers and say, buy my version. It's better than the other person's version. Buy a lot of it. But there's a downside to that, or at least I think there is. With tobacco and alcohol. Marijuana is not the same as those substances, but there's a way in which just unfettered marketing, especially marketing aiming at children, could, I think, do harm and for sure could generate a political backlash against the legalization that's happened so far. So still talking, and I'm going to start with you, Steve, still talking about sort of how the industry is developing in the United States. You've got a really unique perspective on that. What's being done? What do you think is going to be done to really promote diversity, racial and gender diversity, socioeconomic diversity, and who benefits from legalization? Number one, and number two, where are we headed in terms of marketing restrictions and what all that happens? So that's a lot. I hope we can do it concisely.
Sure. Yeah, I'll try to touch on a lot of that. Some of it's challenging in terms of. Trying to have the system set up to benefit those who have been disadvantaged in the past, although there are many states that have included provisions in their competitive licensing processes that allow for extra points for diversity. You know, these are generally a scoring system that a state sets up, and you've seen that in many states. I can't tell you how much it's tipped the scales. I haven't done that kind of analysis. But that at least is out there. Maryland had a provision like that. There's a controversy going on there because the Attorney General there ruled that you actually couldn't use race as a scoring measure to give certain groups additional points unless you prove that there's been discrimination in the past, which is ironic because there's been plenty of discrimination. But not discrimination in licensing, because licensing is never done. So at least in Maryland, that all got messed up. So there are ways, but what California did, obviously I feel very strongly about not having past felonies be a barrier to ownership or certainly employment. One thing I would note briefly is that I think it's also important, this is something happening in California now, we certainly did in Colorado, was to make sure, and this is relevant in Canada as well, especially in like British Columbia, that you make sure those who have been operating, whether it was a gray market or a medical market or whatever it was, but that they have the opportunity to move forward and be part of the bigger system. In Colorado, it very much started with underground dealers becoming caregivers, becoming storefront caregivers, becoming medical marijuana operators, becoming retail operators. I don't know how much you'll see that in the future. I mean, I think Oregon provides that opportunity. California provides that opportunity. So anyway, that's important that those people aren't left out. I mean, I think it would be unfair. British Columbia right now said we need to be an entirely government-run system, and those who have spent years operating the system were just left out and jobless and businessless. So in terms of marketing, just quickly on that, it's really reiterating what I said before in a way. not saying in any way cannabis isn't potentially harmful in some ways. We could discuss the ways in which that may be the case, but it's inarguable that it's less harmful than alcohol. And that's really how it needs to be treated, which is, as I've said this before, which is we shouldn't be thinking in this marketing sense, we shouldn't be thinking that we're making cannabis legal and this is something new and we need to treat it entirely different. We should be thinking that it is a less harmful version of alcohol, with all kinds of medical benefits and health benefits as well. But you have to think of it in that way. We have a terrible alcohol problem in this country, and cannabis is a less harmful alternative, and that is how it needs to be discussed and marketed.
Let's see, so is your bottom line, the answer on marketing is whatever they do with alcohol is about right, or do you have something, I guess I want to push you to say something more substantive than that, which is, okay, so what should the rules be for alcohol and cannabis, really?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you'd be forcing me to figure out how there should be less alcohol advertising in order to answer that, because I very much feel that cannabis needs to be allowed to market cannabis the way you market alcohol. Alcohol cannot have a marketing advantage. There's
so
no
level playing field. Should that playing field be one that is more restrictive than the current alcohol regime?
I wouldn't have a problem if it was more restricted. There's certainly alcohol on all the time. It's pervasive. It's throughout our society. We could go on. I could have a much longer discussion about alcohol use on college campuses and what that's doing, literally causing death and all kinds of other issues. And you don't have any college president saying we should let our students use cannabis instead of alcohol openly, even in states where it's not legal. You don't have college presidents saying those who are 21 and older should have as much opportunity to use cannabis as alcohol. It doesn't have
that. The Dan is literally chomping his bit. Yes. Okay, we'll give Steve a moment here too. But, Dan, I really both of those questions that I posed to Steve, it'd be great if you would address that. And I guess I'm really curious to sort of hear your vision of a essentially non-commercialized rule. And what does that mean for, well, the marketing part of it is going to be easy, but what does that mean in terms of sort of the reparations, which is a strong word?
No, that's the word. I think that's the word. So, I mean, I was talking about that a little bit, but then you stole my thunder and said what I was going to say. So, Steve is absolutely right about a couple of things. First of all, we have a tremendous alcohol problem in this country. And one of the reasons that we have a tremendous alcohol problem in this country is that our alcohol laws are way, way, way too lax. He's also right that marijuana is much safer than alcohol. And when Steve says that rules around marijuana should be no more restrictive than they are for alcohol, in a vacuum, I agree with him. But we don't live in a vacuum. We live in a society with laws and rules for other things. And the fact of the matter is we set the bar way, way too low for alcohol. So when we think about how do we set the rules for marijuana, we should think about how do we set the rules for marijuana. We shouldn't say, how do we set the rules for marijuana vis-a-vis alcohol? Because then we're in a race to the bottom where we've got this bar that's way too low for alcohol, and now we're going to go in even further under that for marijuana. The fact of the matter is the bar for alcohol should be here, and the bar for marijuana should be much lower than that, here. But let's not do a race to the bottom where we try to take away all the laws, all the rules for both products. And on that topic, you know, I think it is a bit of a cop-out, and I want to challenge not just Steve, but everybody in the room, because we're all in the drug policy reform movement. And I've seen countless times people in the drug policy reform movement get upset when people in the media say drug problems and don't include alcohol in that conversation, or when they say drugs and alcohol because it makes alcohol seem like it's not a drug, when we all know that it is. But we in the drug policy reform movement don't include alcohol ourselves in our own work, in our own reform efforts. And I think everyone here in this room recognizes and understands that, at least in the United States and in other countries, although I don't have the international expertise of other folks on this panel, that we have a real problem with alcohol. It is, we say it in our work at NPP and in other organizations, and we mean it because it's right. It is a deadly drug. It is arguably the most harmful drug in our society. I mean, you know, heroin is more harmful in an acute sense, but to the extent that alcohol is more widely used, in large part because our laws are so lax, It is arguably the most harmful and deadly drug in our society, and that's because our laws are too lax, at least in part. And so, you know, it shouldn't be advertised on television. It shouldn't be on billboards in stadiums. And we had this realization with tobacco, where, you know, in the 70s, it was advertised on TV and it was on everything. We had cartoon characters on cigarette boxes, and we thought, this is ridiculous. And we rolled that back, right? But for whatever reason, we haven't had that reckoning with alcohol. Money. And I think it's incumbent on some of the people in this room to have that reckoning with alcohol. On the topic of, you know, reparations, which I think is the right word, you know, we've been at one extreme where black and brown and poor and young people are disproportionately more likely to be thrown in jail. I think there's a temptation to say, okay, now that we're legalizing it, let's make it so that black and brown and poor and young people are disproportionately more likely to get rich. And, you know, I understand that temptation. I think, again, for me, it's not about how do we make policy relative to where policy was, but just what is the right policy? And for me, you know, first and foremost, when I look at the list of reasons why I got involved in drug policy reform, or specifically marijuana policy reform, it is that adults should not be punished for using marijuana. It's just not that harmful. There are better things for law enforcement officers to do with their time. Let's focus on violent crime, real threats to public safety. When I was a prosecutor, I had rape and aggravated assault files that I was ignoring because I was upstairs in Muni Court cleaning out marijuana cases all day. Racially disparate enforcement of the laws. All of those are things that can be addressed and are addressed largely in D.C., where I'm from, where we have strict decriminalization, where we wipe the laws off the books. And marijuana is legal, but we don't necessarily have a large commercial industry. The thing that a large commercial industry does is it makes it easy for you to get marijuana if you want marijuana, and it makes it possible to get rich selling marijuana. And those are just not high on my priority list. The stuff that's high on my priority list is the stuff that I picked off earlier about making sure that the adults who want to use marijuana can do so and not be punished, and ending arrests and giving law enforcement officers better things to do with their time. To the extent that if we want to have that conversation and do those other things and make sure that people can buy marijuana and, you know, have a legal regulated means to have stores, it can be done in ways more responsible than through, you know, a free sale commercial industry. We heard the conversation from Spain, folks who were involved in the illicit market, who were dealers before, have stores. We saw some of that in Colorado in the early days. I would challenge the representation that, you know, Colorado was, that you had to be well capitalized the way that we have the law now in order to be compliant with the law. Most businesses in Colorado were compliant with the law all the way back to 2011-12, in the late medical marijuana days. There were some, obviously some bad examples, but you know, most businesses were compliant and are compliant today. But you know, you could have a government monopoly with a mandate that people who run stores, people who work in stores, you know, you can have a quota for hiring, you can have a point-based system, just like you have with licensing, where you give preference to minority applicants. So that can be done that way as well. But anyway, I'm far as that, but obviously.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. If you're a cannabis brand looking to build trust and awareness within the community, consider becoming a sponsor of this program. Your message will be seen and heard by the most dedicated followers of marijuana policy reform, who are loyal and supportive of those brands that give back to the community. Just log on to MJAgenda.com and click the Become a Patron button to learn how your brand can also be featured in my live nationwide appearances. Thank you for your support.
The Marijuana Agenda, like the gay agenda, only with better music.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is proudly sponsored by the Marijuana Business Association. The MJBA, called by NBC News the Cannabis Chamber of Commerce, is the fastest growing business association and the fastest growing industry in America. I've been working with the MJBA for years, and I personally invite you to join the MJBA. MJBA also publishes the popular MJ Headline News on Facebook and the MJNewsNetwork.com and Marijuana Channel 1 on YouTube. Visit MJBA.net for more details.
total war against public enemy number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
Experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am ill.
That was the point.
I think it would be a mistake to leave the state.
Negative reports coming out of.
Don't smoke marijuana.
I want to riff a little bit on the discussion that was just had between Steve Fox and Dan Riffle, both who are former staffers of the Marijuana Policy Project, with respect to where marijuana policies should be compared to alcohol policies. We're talking about marketing, for example. Should marijuana be allowed to have ads on the Super Bowl to be able to have the same level of marketing as the alcohol companies do? It has to do with retailing. Should marijuana retailers be, you know, as ubiquitous as bars and being able to have social use clubs and being able to buy it everywhere and so forth? These are important policy discussions, and during the discussion, Steve Fox makes the eminently sensible point that marijuana is safer than alcohol. So if alcohol is at a certain level, as far as how it's allowed to be marketed, then marijuana has to be at least at that level and should be lower than that level, because you can't let alcohol have a marketing advantage, right? If marijuana is safer than alcohol and we've got an alcohol problem, then you ought to allow marijuana to advertise as much or more than alcohol. Get more people smoking pot instead of drinking alcohol as a harm reduction measure. Wherever the bar is, pardon the pun, for alcohol, you got to set the bar lower for marijuana. That's the Steve Fox position, which is eminently sensible. And then you also have the Dan Riffle position, which is eminently sensible. And that is that marijuana ought to be set at a policy level where marijuana ought to be set at. We shouldn't be comparing it to alcohol because we set the bar way too low for alcohol. We messed up with alcohol. We should have more restrictions on alcohol. It ought to be tougher. Now, what if we rose those restrictions on alcohol to a sensible level, public policy speaking wise, then we could put marijuana lower than that where it belongs and everything would be fine. But if alcohol is too low and we allow rampant advertising and rampant commercialization and we're going to let marijuana be lower than that, then we got to race to the bottom. That's also an eminently sensible position. So you got two positions here that neither is wrong. It's just a matter of how you're looking at this. And one of the things I fear is that as we move forward in our public policy and our legalization discussions, this debate is no longer being steered by those of us in public policy positions, those of us in activist positions, grassroots positions, working with people on the ground. It's increasingly going to be steered by marijuana industries that are going to want to push their particular vision of legalization. And this also intersects with what we were talking about. It was a big theme of the Drug Policy Reform Conference, the intersectionality of the drug war with people of color, with transgender people, with issues of formerly incarcerated persons and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. And will the commercial route go the route that will best help these people on the ground? Or if we go to the more public policy route, do we see support and support in this form of votes and support in the form of donations dry up because we're not pursuing that capitalistic angle that has gotten us the successes we've had so far, right? I mean, we can say about how the hippies were right, and they were. We can say how the hippies were right about marijuana and the ecology and, you know, the wars and all of that. We can say how they were right. But nothing really changed until money got involved, right? We didn't really see a whole lot of what they fought for until it became profitable. I'm not saying that's a good thing. It's just the way America is, right? So if capitalism got us, you know, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, California, Maine, Massachusetts, and Nevada, you know, capitalism helped get the last eight states, right? So these are important debates that they're having, and it's interesting because one of the things when we're fighting against the Kevin Sabets, we're fighting against the drug war, the prohibitionists out there, We taunt them sometimes. At least I do. We taunt them sometimes with prohibition. It's like, why are you spending so much time on marijuana trying to keep us from smoking a joint? How come you're not up there trying to repeal the 21st Amendment for alcohol prohibition? Why not? Why aren't you trying to bring back alcohol prohibition? And then their response is some form of the culture explanation, right? Well, alcohol's ingrained in our culture. For thousands of years, people have used alcohol. We can't do a thing about alcohol. It's impossible to change anything about alcohol. Never mind that tobacco culture was so ingrained in our society that regularly seeing someone smoke a cigarette on screen was natural. We had restaurants where smoking was allowed. You could smoke on airplanes. Airplanes, people. But we changed that, right? So don't tell me, yeah, culture, we can't change it. But that's the excuse we always hear back from the prohibitionists, right? When we taunt them on the alcohol thing. But Dan Riffle makes a great point. Where are we? The drug war reform movement on the alcohol issue. Where are we, right? See, like, we're all shocked and appalled, and rightfully so, about this opioid overdose crisis we've been talking about, where it's killed 60,000 people in the United States in 2016 alone. Well, that's nothing compared to alcohol. Alcohol is killing 88,000 people a year. That's the average 2006 to 2010, according to the CDC. How come we're not in the drug policy reform movement now? How come we're not freaking out about that? How come we're not ringing the alarm bells about that? Think about this 60 Minutes story that just came out, the Washington Post story. Something that we, by the way, I just want to point out, we've been reporting on this thing, this whole DEA and government allowing Big Pharma to produce a lot of opioids. I've been covering that since 2011. And just now, Tom Marino, this drug czar nominee, loses his nomination, has to withdraw. Because 60 Minutes shows that he was involved with backroom dealing and getting laws surreptitiously passed that handcuffed the DEA from being able to crack down on the pill mills and the opioid epidemic, right? So he had to step down in embarrassment, right? The horror, the complicity. We're all shocked and appalled by this complicity of the government being run to the benefit of the pharmaceutical corporation. Well, folks, the alcohol industry spent almost $24 million lobbying Congress in 2016. There's a lot of alcohol lobbyists out there, and they're a powerful lobby. So again, if we're so concerned about the opiate thing, killing people and corrupting government, where's our outrage with alcohol? So this is the thing that's really confusing about this as well, is that, you know, at these drug policy reform, and I don't mean this to slam DPA or anybody, right? This is not a slam or a dig, because they're at normal events, they're at MPP events, NCIA events. I was at one last night where we drank plenty of alcohol. Hell, some of these events is complimentary. Beer, wine, and cocktails, right? But in all these years that I've been doing drug policy reform, I have yet to see at a drug policy event a panel or a discussion or a presentation on alcohol harm reduction. Now, I mean, they have, let's be fair, there's discussion of, you know, harm reduction for teens, you know, stop binge drinking, you know, call someone if you need a cab. But I mean, like, policy changes, right? Like calling for, well, I'll talk about that. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But, you know, changing advertising, marketing, sales policies, right? So is it, why? Why do we deny this? Just because it's legal? We don't take a position or fight for harm reduction in alcohol policy just because alcohol is a legal drug? Is that why? Or is it, I mean, if it's the deaths, we should be paying attention to this, shouldn't we? I mean, alcohol nearly killed my dad. That's why I'm here. My dad was an alcoholic. Not once did any drug enforcement agent try to break down the door and stop him from drinking alcohol. Not that I'm saying they should. But alcohol was promoted and celebrated and accepted, and hell, back in those days, drunk driving was just a part of the night. That was just kind of an accepted way of things were, right? Which is another example, by the way, of the people, you know, the Kevin Sabets in the world who say, well, alcohol is just intractable. It's been in society for a million years. BS, right? Because drunk driving used to be an acceptable thing, but we figured out how to change that policy. We accepted that that was a bridge too far. And we did not accept that policy anymore. We changed it. We created 0.08 drunk driving laws, which, again, I'm not necessarily defending. I'm just saying we did something, right? I mean, harm reduction was something that we talked about over and over again at this DPA reform conference, talking about, you know, like safe injection facilities for people dependent on heroin, getting naloxone, the opioid overdose cure, into the hands of first responders and other people, you know, testing club drugs. You know, young people going to raves and stuff, you can test your ecstasy tab, make sure it's, you know, the real thing. Drug interaction warnings. Hey, don't mix your opioids with your alcohols, right? That kind of stuff, right? So lots of harm reduction. And we have none of that, or at least not that I'm seeing enough of it with respect to alcohol, the most harmful drug out there. Now, throughout the conference, you know, maybe it is the criminality. Maybe it's because it's legal, right? Because, you know, throughout the conference, we got to end the criminalization of people buying, selling, and producing drugs. But, you know, that's what we have for alcohol. With alcohol, we see the end goal of what we're trying to achieve for other drugs. And 88,000 people die of it every year. And that's not even considering all the societal problems stemming from alcohol, like domestic violence, crime, that kind of stuff. Now, obviously, legalizing marijuana is a different discussion, right? Because legalizing marijuana gives us this luxury. We get to set policy for something that's obviously safer, that's not going to cause any sort of societal calamity that we have to worry. So we got this luxury. We can sit back and not worry about alcohol policy so much. But if we're going to move on and start talking about decriminalizing or even legalizing other drugs, some of these drugs that can be lethal, that can have a greater impact to society, we risk becoming hypocrites if we don't address the drunken elephant in the room. And that's our alcohol policies, which, as Dan Riffle said, are way, way, way too lax. All right, that's all the time we got for today. Thanks for joining us, and on a future rant, I'll tell you a little bit what I would do, maybe tomorrow, to reform our alcohol policies.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
For everyone here at Delta Nine House and Studios, I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us, and until next time. Take care of each other, tokers. You plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes.